Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
And thank you, Adam, and welcome to the History Slam podcast, everybody. I am Sean Graham. We're coming at you nearly live. We're in Ottawa, Ontario, at the University of Ottawa. We're in Hagen Hall, where the Faculty of Postdoctoral Studies is, and I feel very important because I don't get to come in here very often. And we're here because the Vice Dean is Timothy J. Stanley, and he has written a book called Contesting White Supremacy, School Segregation, Anti-Racism, and the Making of Chinese Canadians. And given that recently there's been a lot of contentions, a lot of discussion of whether or not we live in a post-racial world, this would be a good opportunity to talk to Professor Stanley about this book. So, Professor Stanley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Thanks for doing this. So, I would go over all your list of achievements and appointments that you've had over the years, but we only have a finite amount of time, so I won't, other than to say that you're a highly decorated scholar. So I'm very excited to have you here. And this book has been very successful. It won the Clio Award last year for the CHA Best Book About British Columbia. It's won the Founders Prize for Best English Language Book from the Canadian History of Education Association. So a well-decorated book. And so it's about anti-racism, school segregation in British Columbia. Now, why did you write this book?
Why did I write this book? This book actually started many years ago, as my partner likes to remind me, as my PhD thesis. And I had done a master's degree in Chinese history at UBC. And then I had gotten active in anti-racism education, community education in British Columbia, and was interested in exploring further issues of anti-racism education. In that era, the only people doing this were in education. So much to my surprise, I ended up doing a PhD in education, where one of my areas was history of education. And it made sense at some level to do a thesis that drew on my skills in Chinese history and on questions of racism. So I became interested in the 1922 Chinese student strike in Victoria. And 25 years later, I produced this book.
Yeah, so that background, it's the timeline is... You know, it happens.
I read a few things in the meantime.
Yeah, it's not like you haven't done anything in between the two. Come on. So, yeah, and that background of Chinese history comes through in the book, and it comes through quite early in the introduction when you're talking about your methodology and the historiography, because one of the things you use extensively in the book are Chinese sources. So I'm wondering, how does this differentiate your interpretation or your understanding of this topic from previous people who've looked at this?
Well, scholarship's always additive, and I couldn't have done my work if it wasn't for work that had been done by other scholars earlier, Patricia Roy, Peter Ward, amongst others. But most accounts of the history of racism in Canada, at least as they affect Asian Canadians, are based on English language sources only. And as a result, they misread what racism is. Racism, whatever else it is a social relation. So if you're going to understand racism as a social relation, you need to have access to the self-representations of people on both sides. So not just what white supremacists say about the Chinese, but what did the Chinese say about the white supremacists saying those things about them.
Right.
And it's sort of odd because, if in most other fields of history, nobody would get away with this. If you said you wanted to do a study of Chinese-Albanian relations and you didn't read Chinese or Albanian, your thesis supervisor would tell you to choose another topic.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of odd that when it comes to this, we often assume that the English language sources are enough, and they're not.
Yeah, you got to provide that extra context because... These are the people who are being persecuted.
Exactly.
Yeah. But it's not just that these Chinese sources that you're using. You also have a different way of interpreting the English language sources.
Part of the claim that I want to make is that if you want to actually document incidents of racism, these tend to be documented much more frequently, much more commonly in Chinese language sources. We see this particularly in the newspaper that I heavily rely on, the Chinese Times, which is the one newspaper that's available really as a complete run for Canada during the period I'm concerned with. But when I read English language sources, I also, and indeed when I read my Chinese language sources, my readings are also shaped by my understanding of theory. And in particular, anti-racist theory, cultural theory, processes of cultural representation. So when somebody says something about the Chinese, I don't read them as necessarily so much describing an external reality to the source, but rather as constituting knowledge that sort of is inseparable from the source. So this is an application of Stuart Hall's theories of cultural representation, in which we see a representation, which in the end is our source as a historian, as not separate from event, but as constitutive of it. So when somebody writes a source and says the Chinese behave in X way, what they're doing is they're actually inventing and reinventing the category of Chinese. They're saying they're creating knowledge of it. So it's not like that there's some pre-existing unproblematic group called the Chinese, or for that matter called Canadians, that is then being described. The sources are actually making knowledge of them. So it's a much more active process.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to just reading it and almost restating what has been said.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of historical scholarship at times tends to take categories that are in sources for granted, mm-hmm. as if the social categories the sources describe are objective and neutral and not things that are actually in the process of becoming and being contested, being remade all the time. Right. And indeed, all social categories are like that.
Right, so something like the term Chinese in the book is obviously about anti-Chinese racism. The term Chinese isn't a finite name. It constantly changes.
Well, one of the points I make in the book is that in the 19th century, the term Chinese is an ascription. The people who came to Canada from South China didn't call themselves Chinese and didn't think of themselves as Chinese. There's a term that's often translated as Chinese, which means sort of civilized people. They thought of themselves as part of those people who were members of Chinese civilization. But that's a term that includes elites in Vietnam and Korea and Central Asia as much as it does anybody in what is now China. And doesn't include everybody who lives in the borders of what's now China. Most people, while they were officially citizens of or subjects of the Qing Empire, they didn't speak Mandarin. They spoke different mutually unintelligible dialects of Cantonese and Hakka. And most people thought of themselves as somebody from this town or this village or this county, not as any kind of overarching identity as Chinese. So there was no group called the Chinese except in the white supremacist imagination.
So in this ascription of a race or a title, like this is sort of how you define race in a way, something that is ascribed to people, and then maybe they would self-identify as such, mm-hmm. As opposed to the self-identification coming first, right? Mm-hmm. Is that how we define race then?
Well, I'm careful not to use the term race in my work, because I think part of the problem is, you know, people commonly understand racism as some kind of prejudice or discrimination based on race, as if race has an objective existing way of being in the world. And in fact, race, for all of its permanency as categories, are actually highly dynamic. You know, in early 19th century Britain, the Irish were black.
Right.
Until the late 1970s, early 1980s in Britain, if you were somebody who was born in Hong Kong living in Britain, you were called black and called yourself black. Mm-hmm. It's a term that means it's actually nonsensical in the North American context.
Right.
But that's how the racialization was working. Mm-hmm. So instead I talk about racialization, which is the social process of really inventing race, of mm-hmm. marking race. And that draws attention to language and how language is used to constitute and establish difference. So racialization is the social process of making race. It's fundamentally a process of cultural representation. So an example of this is when the first anti-Chinese measures introduced into the House of Commons in 1778 by a member from British Columbia, the Prime Minister of the time, Alexander Mackenzie, literally lasted out of the House of Commons on the grounds that the Chinese are as good British subjects as the honorable members, and that the suggestion is an invidious distinction that's incompatible with a British dominion. Within 8 years, Johnny Macdonald is standing up in the House of Commons and saying that the Chinese are a separate species from those of Europeans, in effect inventing into law the idea of race as a marker. Mm-hmm. So it's actually something you can actually trace historically, the invention and creation and popularization of all these categories.
Right. And is it based on skin color because that's just an easy marker?
Racism is not necessarily based on skin color. It's also based on other sorts of things. A classic example of racism is anti-Semitism in Europe.
Yeah.
It's based on a construction of difference that is then represented as being absolute and unbridgeable.
Right.
And then race as a category gets reinforced by this process of representation. So what I argue is not that race that leads to racism. It's racism that leads to race.
So if racism then creates race, then what is the cause of racism? In a lot of the stuff that I've read about the civil rights movement, a lot of it has to do with just fear. The people in the South aren't sure of what's going to happen once slavery ends. And they're just scared of what's going on. And that leads to this prejudice. So is fear really the motivation, or is that what causes racism? Or what really is the root cause of racism, you think?
Well, I think it's the fact of a racist slavery. So you have a racist slavery system, and people are suddenly afraid when it's ending, perhaps, and that fear is rooted in something. But it's fundamentally rooted in the fact of a racist system called racialized slavery in the United States and elsewhere in the Americas, which is itself part of a broader process through which, you know, people leave Europe and take control over the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason that you do this is, you know, the reason that somebody would move from Britain or from Eastern Canada to British Columbia in the 19th and early 20th century is so that they could become property owners and become wealthy, make fame and fortune. Small detail, they're doing it on the territories of the First Nations that are still unceded to this day, and they quickly convert their land, their territories into private property. So they create a whole system of control.
Right.
The problem in this is that another group of would-be property owners enter into the territory called British Columbia at the same time. These are the Chinese. Mm-hmm. The point of having British gunboats on the Fraser River is not to create property for people from China.
Yeah.
It's to create property from so-called British people, which is people from Eastern Canada, people from Britain itself. And that's why, in essence, apartheid gets invented in British Columbia. The third act, I believe, of the BC legislature takes the vote away from all First Nations in British Columbia and all Chinese people. The First Nations are overwhelming majority, and the Chinese are probably the majority of the adult male population.
In the introduction, you say that it's not just the British or white people who have made a place like Victoria, a quote, "The Chinese, too, had made Victoria with their sweat, their talent, and their wealth. Above all, they were no different from any other sample of humanity, people of multiple and complex moral qualities." Mm-hmm. This is what you're talking about, is that they're founding and they're creating this place just like anyone else, but they're the ones who are being prejudiced against because of this colonial mentality.
Sure. In 1922, for example, the Victoria School Board decides to segregate all the people of Chinese race on the grounds that they don't speak English, they threaten the progress of other students, all this sort of stuff. Amongst the students, almost all the students segregated are locally born Chinese. They're people who are born there, most of whom speak English as their first and often only language. In one case, one of the children being segregated is a third-generation person born in Victoria. The only people with deeper roots in the city were the Songhees people.
Mm-hmm. You
know? So this myth that somehow the Chinese arrive and are alien, in fact, when the other aliens are also the whites, the people of European origin, it's just that they're making the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And through processes of power, they have the ability to make those rules and have them stick.
Right. So the book really starts then with this strike in 1922 and 1923. I want to read the first line of the book.
Sure.
All right. This is how the book starts. "On September 5th, 1922, shortly after classes began in the new school year of the Victoria, British Columbia School District, the principals of some of the district's elementary schools called certain students out of their classes, lined them up, and marched them down the road. These principals were putting into effect a school board order to segregate these children from their peers." That's how the book starts, and that hit me in the face. I was like, whoa, all right. Like, to me, that's a great hook. Like, in part because I did not know that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the first question I have is, why did I not know that this happened? Why isn't this a more celebrated thing nationally?
Short of asking how you prepared for your comprehensive exam.
No.
I think that far too long, this history has been seen as specific to British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're elsewhere in the country, it doesn't really matter. It's sort of something that people would say, oh, yes, there's that stuff over
right.
there.
Yeah, like it's like racism in BC yeah. is leading up to the Second
sure.
World War is expected.
Yeah, it's like normal. So this right. so this is particular to that. But I would argue that what's missing here is the way in which Canadian state formation at all levels is in the end has been historically white supremacist. And it takes different forms in different parts of the country. You know, in Ontario, where we are, there were when they created separate schools, the Egerton Ryerson also created separate schools for blacks.
Hmm.
And black separate schools exist in Ontario legally until 1966. You know, the height of the U.S. Civil Rights Movement, finally the Ontario legislature abolished them.
Right.
You know, just to put that in perspective. Across the country, we see it in the whole regime and control and system of control of Indian affairs mm-hmm. and all the consequences that people experience. In this as well, as I document in my book, as they're creating this idea of a Chinese alien, they're creating an equally racialized category called a Canadian.
Mm.
And that's a project that is not particular to British Columbia. You know, the textbooks that I cite are published in Ontario and used across the country
yeah.
as an example that are doing this.
So the response then of this segregation is a student strike.
Yes.
The Chinese students go on strike.
Yes.
Through their families. Now, as I read about this, it reminded me, or it seemed as though there could be some parallels with the Montgomery bus mm-hmm. boycott mm-hmm. in the United States at the start of the Civil Rights Movement. What I'm curious about is, how did the strike get mobilized? Because I'm assuming that the second graders who were segregated and asked to go to school, it wasn't necessarily their idea, because maybe they weren't as conscious as what was going on. So how did this mobilize, and how did it continue through the next year? Because it's an amazing stat that Chinese students went from 216 to 6 from one year to the next. So that's how effective the strike was.
Yeah, and those 6 were only there for like a week or two.
Right.
So there's a number of things that happened. First is, starts goes back to the late 19th century, is the invention of institutions for self-defense and unity mobilization, of which the most important is the Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association, which David Lai has argued is a form of Chinese self-government. Linked to that as well is the development of a Chinese nationalist identity. And Chinese nationalism actually develops first in overseas Chinese communities like that of Victoria, a little bit before it does in China itself. So people like Sun Yat-sen are organizing all the revolutionary movements in the overseas communities, including that of Victoria. So by the time of the strike, you have a community which is overwhelmingly made up of adult men who are living separate from families because they can't bring them into Canada because of the head tax, but who see them, who have this developed sense of a Chinese nationalism. So whereas 50 years earlier, there was no Chinese, now there is a Chinese. Secondly, you have a significant group of second generation people who, because of the skewed demographics of the community, are almost entirely from the upper-class merchants' background. So they're people who, relatively speaking, have a lot of cultural capital. They're also people who are dependent upon access to English-language public schools in order to make their way in the world. Because they're sort of, they don't have the cultural capital that their parents had in terms of Chinese stuff. Going to China is not really an option for them.
Right.
And this group had actually invented the idea, the category of Chinese-Canadian a few years earlier. We see it in 1914 with the formation of the Chinese-Canadian Club, who are the key mobilizers of the strike. So, you have this group that is well-connected to the elite of the community, who has a certain level of literacy in how the dominant society works, which is fairly developed, includes some university graduates, and is also sort of well connected to the elite of the Chinese community. And they play the key role in mobilizing the strike. And in some instances, the people they're mobilizing are their own children, who are third generation. In one instance, I document as a fourth generation child. And in other instances, it's, you know, brothers and sisters, relatives, cousins. There's a kind of a network of stuff. But the remarkable thing that they do is they build support from the entire Chinese community in Victoria. They raise funds in they get support from Vancouver. Some subsequent research done by Lisa Marr has shown they're also getting support in the United States. At the height of the strike, they're beginning to mobilize to organize a boycott of Canadian goods in China itself.
Oh, wow.
Which is not wasn't really an idle threat, but yeah. was the sort of thing that's happening.
Oh, wow.
So there's a high degree of mobilization that they're able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And on a whole other level, the Chinese community was a small town. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody knew each other's business.
Right.
So there's also a lot of pressure from the community to maintain the strike.
Mm-hmm. And how much of it, too, is that, on the surface at least, some of the reasons that the school board is putting out for the segregation, they're not saying we're prejudiced. They're saying, you know, it's to teach in the English language and to teach British culture.
Sure.
And government. Well, so how much is that a factor, that the reason is the rationale from the school board is somewhat flimsy on its surface?
Well, it's interesting. Throughout the entire strike, the term racist isn't used. It's not a term that really gains currency till after the Second World War. People talk about the school board is denounced for being race prejudiced, for their racial prejudice. And they explicitly deny throughout the strike that their things are racially motivated, even though their measures are only applying to students of Chinese race. And the second generation people with some other key supports are extremely effective in the English language press of debunking all the school board's arguments. So, you know, the school board says that they don't speak English. Well, then you have all these letter writers who are second generation people who are products of the local school system who quite clearly only speak English but can write it very effectively, thank you, and also mobilize all of the arguments about, you know, British fair play and all this sort of stuff for their cause. So the school board, as the community answers the school board's claims, every time the school board said we need to segregate them for X reason, within a matter of a few days, the community was able to say, well, X reason doesn't apply, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the key propagandists for the strike, a half-Chinese fellow by the name of Harry Hastings, publishes an entire list in the newspaper of the students and their class standings. And most of the students who are being segregated because they're supposedly slowing down the education of the rest of the students are in the top third of their classes.
They're
not exactly falling behind, no. Yeah. So how are they slowing anybody down is not really clear.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and so coming in, so going through the strike, it struck me that this is really the foundation of a movement mm-hmm. that continues through the 20s and the 1930s mm-hmm. within this community to address, if not completely mm-hmm. abolish, mm-hmm. racism and mm-hmm. And the segregation that they go. And that's sort of the tangent that the book follows. And what I really liked about it is that it's the sort of thing that we don't get a lot in Canadian history, I don't think. This type of movement, I mean, it's the sort of thing that you see, like I said, with the civil rights movement, and that to me is the parallel. But it's something that, in my experience, and granted, I've never studied in British Columbia, maybe that's why, but like it's something that we don't see a lot, and that's what I really enjoyed about it.
See, I don't know whether we don't see a lot of it, because I think what we don't see a lot of it in the work of Canadian historians.
Okay.
I think it actually is extremely present in the reality of communities that experience racism. Every community that I can think of has mobilized to fight racism in systemic ways and done it through different kinds of institutions.
Right.
You can see it, for example, in the Africadian community in Nova Scotia. Not only is there groups like the Black Citizens Coalition, but the whole role of people who were mobilized around the different community churches, for example, for over 100 years fighting back. You have the same sorts of things, you know, amongst Sikhs in British Columbia, where they organize around the gurdwaras since 1907 to resist sort of thing. Perhaps the clearest example is the case of First Nations people. So like now we're struck by the I Don't Know More movement.
Yeah.
But there's a long history of First Nations and your Métis peoples organizing collectively and organizationally and imaginatively, you know, in different ways to fight for justice. In the old days when it was illegal for status Indians to meet in groups of larger than five except for religious purposes, the Native Brotherhood of BC organized a fishing union because it was illegal to organize a land claims union. And so they would sing Onward Christian Soldiers for several hours till the RCMP and the local RCMP officer and the Indian agent left, and then they'd have their political meeting. What's happened is that Canadian historians, I think, have for a large part ignored these histories and haven't really brought them into the into our the central consciousness, if you will, of what constitutes Canada and its past.
Because that leads me into something else that you've written, an article called "Why I Killed Canadian History," which is a response to Jack Granestein's book of why or who killed Canadian history. And what I found when I looked through this article is that it struck me that there's probably a way that what you're arguing and what he's arguing, they're not completely incompatible, I don't think. But you think that maybe it's not as compatible as I do. I don't want to put you on the spot and make you talk about Jack Granestein, but...
Well, as I mentioned in the article, it's a bit personal. You know, he says the people who killed Canadian history are social historians, which I am, professors of education, which I am, you know, multicultural educators, which he doesn't know about anti-racist educators, but for in his terms, that's me. And then he gives it, and he says bad historical writers, and he actually gives a quote from one of my articles, which he doesn't attribute the source, and it does have a terrible typo in it, I will admit that.
Okay, but so. But what... Okay, yeah, that's I get that. But what I take away from Jack Granestein and is that he doesn't want us to forget national figures and broad national stories. And it seems to me that what you're writing about is, while it's a local, it helps inform a wider national story, because you were just talking about different movements and different forms of racism, different prejudices that have existed in this country. And here's one example that can help inform other stories, right?
Well, it's an interesting thing you're thinking about, because on a whole other front, I think one of the problems in racism is nationalism, because I think that all nationalisms are in the end racist, because they draw a line between who's inside and who's outside that becomes absolute. So I do have a concern about... So I'm less interested in preserving national history than most other people are.
Sure.
I'm very interested in encouraging people to explore and engage in history and historical thinking knowledge. But what I would like people to do is to make the nation state into a problem to be understood and studied, rather than to take it as the taken for granted framework that shapes all of our understandings. And I think one of the problems in nationalist history, which is the dominant form of history that I think historians in Canada write, but also is popularly reproduced, is the way it silences the history of white supremacy.
Right.
So an example to me is, you know, recently the National Capital Commission renamed the Ottawa River Parkway after Sir John A. Macdonald. And I wrote an opinion piece in the Ottawa Citizen after this, suggesting this was inappropriate because Macdonald was a white supremacist. You know, in 1885, not only does he disenfranchise the Chinese and all First Nations people, except for a few in Ontario who own property and vote for the Tories, but his views in the House of Commons are the most extreme of any member of the House of Commons or in the Senate. He argues the Chinese are a separate species, and that's why they shouldn't have the right to vote. Other people were objecting to Chinese cultural practices. He's objecting to Chinese biology. So if we want, and I would argue that's the moment when white supremacy becomes made into law as a legal principle that's formative of Canada for the next 70 years. So if we want to remember John A. Macdonald, let's remember him not as the founder of the country, but also the founder of Canadian white supremacy.
Right.
That you don't see, because it's incompatible with the nationalizing purpose of wanting to commemorate Macdonald.
I guess then it gets down to the sort of what's the purpose of history. And you know, I tend to look at it as trying to understand where we come from and sort of understand how we got here. And I know that's probably a fourth grade interpretation, but for me, that's sort of what it's part about. And like you're saying, you have to understand it in the whole, and you can't take one without the other, right?
True.
So that's why that's why I think part of it might be compatible to two. Like, it is a nation, right? It is a coast-to-coast nation, and trying to understand the construction of that, this is a key component of, like, the racism is a component of the construction of the state.
Well, a couple of things. Yeah, I would argue that that's so, and I would argue as well that it's not merely a thing of the past, that it continues to be so.
Absolutely.
And that certainly, as a citizen, this is an issue to be of concern. One of the problems I would question is, who is this we? And who gets to decide who is in the we, that this is supposedly our history?
Sure.
You know, most young people in Canada will tell you that their most boring course that they do is their history courses, their history social studies courses.
Yep.
And they don't see themselves in this we. It's not who they are and where they are. And many groups are actually excluded from this we. And, you know, most explicitly Chinese Canadians, you know, up to the present, you can't have the idea that, you know, the recent controversy on the $100 bill, you can't have an Asian face that represent Canadians.
Right.
Even though there wouldn't be a West Coast if it wasn't for the fact of the Chinese workers who established Captain John Muir's fort that got on the Victoria on Vancouver Island that got the British claim established.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And really throughout the country, I mean, you know,
Chinese
communities in Saskatchewan.
And Chinese is thought of as a foreign language.
Right.
So history departments in Canada, they have language requirements. If you want to do Canadian history, they say you have to learn English and French. They don't say you have to learn English, French, and Chinese.
Right.
Or English and French and Ukrainian. Or,
yeah. Or any host of languages.
Or any of the Aboriginal languages.
Right. Yeah.
You know, why shouldn't all Canadian historians have to know the Indigenous language of the place where they do their PhD in?
Yeah, it'd be more inclusive and really understanding everything.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, particularly being in this office, all the practical difficulties. Yeah. but it doesn't even enter into our imagination as possible discussions.
A quote again from the book on page 233, you say, "History can help with anti-racist projects. Historical understanding makes visible the vast silences and exclusions that frame our day-to-day cultural landscapes." And that touches a little bit on what we've just been talking about. But as a specific, can the racism in Victoria and the segregation in the school board, can that help our understanding of Japanese internment in British Columbia during the Second World War?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think every little project that sort of helps us to understand racism and the dynamics of racism can help us to understand other racisms and their dynamic. And certainly in the history of Canada, the anti-Chinese racism and anti-Japanese racism sort of, you know, leapfrogs one with the other. And there's particularities in each case linked to the broader global politics. But I would argue that what happens in internment, again, I would disagree with Jack Ranenstein, is in the end, the white supremacists see their chance and use it to get rid of the Japanese, and do so involving, amongst other things, a massive transfer of property. You know, in one of the differences between, we often think of the U.S. as the place where it has severe racism. In fact, this is yet one more example where the racism was more intense in Canada. In Canada, all the people who were forcibly removed from the West Coast lost their property too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, who bought it? Where did that property go?
Right.
And they didn't get it back. A quarter of them were repatriated in 1945 to Japan, even though Japan was recovering, something the United States never did. Mm-hmm. And it included many Canadian-born people who didn't even speak Japanese.
Yeah, people had never been to Japan before.
And in the United States throughout, Japanese Americans could vote because they were citizens. Japanese Canadians only got to vote in 1949.
Right.
So we often, that's to say those of us who live in this place, often represent Canada as this place of this sort of kinder, gentler, more peaceable kingdom compared to those terrible Americans and their history of violent racism. In fact, the history of state-organized violent racism is probably stronger in Canada than it is in the United States.
Hmm. Yeah, because, like you say, there's plenty of examples of it. And And so with that particular respect, if you look at Japanese internments as just opportunity to get rid of Japanese from the white community in British Columbia, I mean, that sentiment would be born out of similar feelings as the school segregation with the Chinese, right? Like,
yeah, similar.
Those power dynamics.
Similar kinds of power dynamics, similar kinds of representation. Throughout this whole thing, and this has a continuity up to the present, there's an ongoing practice of representing somehow so-called Canadians, that is to say people of European origin who speak English, preferably these days with a standard CBC accent, as somehow native and proper and naturally belonging here. Mm-hmm. And anybody who is different from that is not. You know, I had a student from the Musqueam First Nation years ago who was telling me about an incident where she was waiting for the bus with her daughter, and her daughter was a bit rambunctious, and this older woman, as they got on the bus, told her to go, said to her, "Why don't you go back to where you came from?" You know, well, hello, she's like, she's from you.
Yeah,
you know, like,
I'm here, I'm good.
And she said, how do I even answer that? You know, like, where do you begin?
Yeah.
But it's this perception and this constant nationalizing project that creates this normal idea of to be Canadian is to be X. Mm-hmm. And somebody who's not that cannot be.
Right.
Right? And we see that widely reproduced, and we also see it invented. And it's being invented by John A. MacDonald when he's saying that Canadians should have the right to vote and Chinese shouldn't.
Right.
He's making the distinction that somehow there's two things, groups in the world, that are racialized and different, and one can't be the other. One's Chinese and one's Canadian.
Mm. So like his 1891 campaign of like the old chieftain, the old flag and all this, he's creating this idea of what is
Canadian. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. He's inventing it. And invented it fairly effectively, and it's since been made the subject of required school curriculum, and generations of people have been indoctrinated into it, and it's still an idea that is alive and well.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, to that last point, then, I mean, I think I know what your answer is going to be to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Of any contention or anybody who's argued that we do, in fact, live in a post-racial world, do you buy into that, and do we live in a post-racial world?
Obviously, this person's never spoken to a First Nations person in Canada. I don't buy this argument at all. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And even in the United States, where people say, well, you know, yes, a black man can now be president, so it's change. And this, there is, I don't want to deny that there isn't a significant change that allowed the election of Obama. But in terms of the reality on the ground, it hasn't changed.
Is a post-racial world possible?
Sure. Racisms and process of racialization were historical inventions. They're product primarily in the last 500 years. And that alone means that if they were invented, they could be uninvented.
Right.
Will I live to see it? Unlikely. I think that one of the things to think about is that it's taking us this long to create this racializing world. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to take us this long to uninvent it.
Well, that's something to think about then as we move forward. So thank you so much for doing this. I really do appreciate
it. My pleasure.
I enjoyed it. So that is Timothy Stanley from the University of Ottawa, Vice Dean here at the Faculty of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral...
Faculty of Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies.
There we go.
I'm also a professor in the Faculty of Education.
Yes, and cross-appointed with history.
Yes, sometimes.
Yeah. You're just all over the place.
Yeah.
And the book is Contesting White Supremacy, School Segregation, Anti-Racism, and the Making of Chinese Canadians. Winner of multiple awards. You can go check it out. It's a great read. I highly recommend it. And if you have any comments, questions for the podcast, you can find me at historyslam@gmail.com, on Twitter at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.